I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup. At the dark and sombre winter's end, Arts Roundup takes time to look at artwork from warmer climes, investigates artists' obsessions with death, looks at the occult and its influence on contemporary art, talks to people who've been outlandish monsters, and samples the tale of an intriguing and fascinating woman practicing the dark art of wartime espionage. In this edition, we visit the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology as it opens a new Tapper exhibition of bark cloth paintings from the Pacific region. Author Claire Mully talks on her biography of aristocratic spy Christine Granville. We review Changing Spaces' Memento Mori exhibition in Green Street with Angie Main. Even darker truths are investigated by visiting academics at Cambridge University's conference Visions of Enchantment, Occultism, Spirituality and Visual Culture on the study of Western esotericism and art. And former actor Colin Walsh looks back on his role in being a Doctor Who series monster. If you're looking for something striking and a bit different to brighten up your day in the city centre in the next few weeks, it's really worth dropping into the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology to take a peek at the Tapper barkcloth paintings from the Pacific exhibition that's just opened. Painted barkcloths, known as Tapper, range from striking and colourful clothing to large wall hangings and tapestries, using an ancient technique of soaking and beating of the bark of certain kinds of tropical tree found in the Pacific Islands. Examples include work from Fiji, Tonga, Papua New Guinea, Samoa, Cook Island and the Solomon Islands. It's a world-class exhibition belonging to the museum's collection dating back to Captain Cook's voyages and features optically dynamic abstract patterns, depictions of animal and plant life and sacred creatures and mythic narratives. The Archaeology and Anthropology Museum's Senior Research Associate, Dr. Julie Adams, says they were a vital trading and ceremonial currency and are even used to wrap up babies to the present day.
The exhibition comes out of a show that we worked on last year, which was actually in Birmingham, in an art gallery setting in Birmingham, in the Icon Gallery. Basically, they've got this huge space and they wanted to have a show of bark cloths. And one of the things about bark cloths is that quite often they're so large that we simply don't have the space to display them here in the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. So we collaborated with the Icon Gallery and had this show last May, which had 23 of our most beautiful and large bark cloth on exhibit there. And it was such a success that we thought, you know, even though we don't have a big space in this museum, we'd like to try and give our own audiences, a display that they could enjoy here. So we've got these cloths, we've got 9 cloths, so it's a reduced version of that exhibition, but we picked the ones that A, would fit in the room, and B, that we thought were particularly stunning to show in this show. The techniques of making bark cloth and the traditions of making bark cloth came from Southeast Asia and then into the Pacific Islands as people moved and settled through those islands. So basically it's an ancient technique, and it's usually made from a particular type of tree, which is the paper mulberry tree. It can be made from other types of trees as well. And islanders basically strip the bark, remove the tough outer layer, and you're left with the kind of slightly softer inner bark, which is then soaked and then beaten, basically. They have most islanders use a kind of big wooden anvil, spread the bark out over that anvil, get a really heavy wooden beater and pound the bark until it becomes really soft.
So it's then like cotton, isn't it?
Yes, exactly, And there's different techniques in different islands, but basically people would work on kind of smallish size sheets and then kind of glue and paste them onto larger sheets until you can get cloths that can be, you know, many, many, many metres in size.
And then they're dyed in these extraordinary colours. Do the patterns have an interesting provenance on them? Because obviously you've got them in different colours here, in blacks and blues and oranges and things like that. I mean, do those patterns have an interesting provenance?
That's a really interesting question. In some places, just to say, in some places the cloths weren't dyed. For example, in Tahiti, they made this really beautiful, fine, pure white, undyed bark cloth. And that was the reserve of chiefs, of the highest people in the community wore that bark cloth. So, but as you say, the ones that we've got on display here are some really beautiful, vibrant colours, and they were made. The dyes come from different roots or vegetable dyes, plants, nuts, and I think one that we've got here from the Cook Islands, they've used turmeric, and the colours are beautiful peach and lemon, you know, really. And this particular cloth was came to us in 1901. So it's the beauty of the colours has survived that amount of time in the museum.
They certainly saw, and they certainly make beautiful pieces of clothing and large scale wall hangings, yeah, with sort of patterns as artworks. Were those given on special occasions to people for their houses, like weddings and things like that?
There's a whole different range, and we tried to show that in the exhibition. Some of the smaller pieces were worn as kind of the loincloth, but other larger pieces were used as kind of dividers in your house, to divide up into different rooms. But a lot of them, as you say, were basically acted as, they were wealth items. So if you were going to the wedding of a chief, your village would make huge quantities, I mean, absolutely vast quantities of bark cloth to present, and the kind of the prestige of your own village would be represented through these cloths.
And people still make these today, don't they?
They do, yes.
In which countries and where are they traded?
Yeah, in lots of the Pacific Islands, cloth is still made today and still presented at these ceremonies.
How long does the exhibition go on till?
The exhibition runs until the 19th of April, strongly recommend anyone who hasn't seen these kind of items before to come and have a look.
Are there any tales or stories behind these that I should know about?
There's lots of different stories. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the larger pieces that we've got on display here from Fiji is a beautiful example of the different way that these cloths communicate to people. So for us, I think quite often European audiences are drawn to the particular cloths that have got maybe fish and dolphins and birds on them. But actually in the Pacific Islands, the power of the designs was not necessarily in what they represented literally, but in the way the designs communicated a sense of awe and power. So the ones from Fiji have got these real geometric patterns, these triangles, different colours. And you can just imagine when it was unwrapped or presented at a ceremony, the kind of the intake of breath as other islanders would see the skill that had gone into the making of these cloths.
It's certainly a stunning collection. Obviously, the Ark and Anthropology Museum, refurbished recently, has many other things to come and have a look at here as well.
Yeah.
What's coming up over the summer in terms of events and things like that?
Well, at the moment we've got, actually, which ties in really nicely with this bark cloth exhibition, is we've got a show about our collections from Fiji, which are the strongest collections that we have here, and some of the strongest in the museum. And so that's a nice parallel. And that closes also on the 19th of April. And shortly after that, we'll be opening an exhibition of illustrated manuscripts, Buddhist manuscripts. The exhibition's called Buddha's Words. So, look out for that.
And Dr. Julie Adams, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
The secrets and lives of World War II SOE secret agents are much documented as a kind of national pastime and obsession, but not much has been written on female agents that really brings their daring exploits to life. I've been looking at a biography of Polish aristocrat Christine Granville, a spy who lived out her dangerous existence in several theatres of operations in the Second World War as a glamorous and deadly agent trained by SOE to assassinate and sabotage Nazis and supply Allied resistance groups. Author Claire Mully talks on her biography that sucks you into a life consciously led like an adrenaline-filled picaresque adventure.
First of all, before we get into what's in the book, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how did you come to take on this entire subject?
Well, it's my second biography. My first one was a biography of the founder of Save the Children, and it won the Daily Mail Prize for Biography. I was delighted, and that sort of enabled me to do more work. And I was very interested in Polish politics, which I'd looked at in my first degree, and I taught English as a foreign language in Poland. And I felt that the history of Poland, particularly their role in the Second World War, wasn't as well known today as it had been. And I was very interested in special agents as well. I'd known a special agent when I was at university, although I didn't know because they kept the secret until they died. And this story, well, my agent suggested it because it brought together those interests for me. But I really felt it was a bit like a blind date, and I wanted to find my own subject and be self-determined.
Why Poland particularly? Where are you from yourself?
I don't have a personal link apart from that I used to live there teaching English for a short while. Yeah. So it's a fascinating country because as today you see again with the developments, what's happening in the Ukraine. It's one of those buffer countries, and so its borders have been very cross, and it's got a very, very rich history.
Yeah, the book is basically it's a very painstakingly put together biography, which has lots and lots of real events, and then you've kind of weaved it together into something that I think a lot of people call kind of faction nowadays, which is that you almost as a witness to the events as they take place. Is that a difficult thing to do?
Well, it's not intended to be faction. It's intended to be fact. I mean, it is entirely factual. So if I quote someone in there, it's quoted from letters they've written, diary entries, reports that they've written. So everything in there, you know, if I've got a weather report, it's checked with a weather report centre. You know, everything in there is factually correct. But I hope that it is, you know, a page-turning book. I didn't want to write dry history. Yeah, this wasn't a dry woman. This was a woman who loved life and excitement and danger.
Christine Granville, who was she and what did she do? She was a half-Jewish Polish aristocrat, wasn't she?
She was indeed, yes. She was born to a very wealthy aristocratic. Her father was from this old Polish family. So she was grown up with a lot of wealth and freedom and a lot of love and adoration. But because her mother had been born Jewish, she was never really fully accepted in the higher echelons of Polish society. So I think she grew up yearning to be free and to get centre stage as well in a way that was denied women in the 1930s.
And there's very much a sense of that during the course of the book, that she had this, and she was very, very good looking. Obviously, socially very able and so on, but she seemed to want...
Useful
future she wanted spy. Social acceptance at the highest level, didn't she?
Well, she did, and she was denied it because she was a woman, and then she became a divorcee, and then she changed her religion so that she could divorce, and she was, you know, she wasn't seen as particularly socially acceptable in many ways. And of course, it was the war subverting the sort of usual social standards of things that enabled her to take centre stage. You know, someone who'd always lived in the margins. She was able, in fact, centre stage is an anagram of secret agent. I've always liked that. So, it enabled her to have that active role. She lived as a man might, perhaps.
Well, that's it. That's what's so incredible about her, because in an era where women didn't step out of the box and do terribly dangerous and daring things, and yet she was one of those people who just almost thrived on the thrill of real life adventure.
Yeah, lots of people say that she loved danger. She certainly loved adrenaline. In fact, the book is called The Spy Who Loved, and it's because she loved life in its widest sense. She loved adrenaline and adventure. She loved danger. She loved men. She had two husbands and, you know, many lovers. But above all, she loved freedom and independence, both for her country, Poland originally, for the Allies, and for herself personally. And I think those things are very strongly intertwined for her.
In the course of your research, are women spies, do they have kind of abilities which are absolutely, completely different from men and absolutely essential if you're trying to win a war? I mean...
There is one thing, I think, and that is the gender prejudice of the times. You know, if, I mean, Christine was our first female special agent and the longest serving. She worked in three different theatres of the war. Most women weren't recruited for another 2 years, and nearly all of them only worked in France. And Christine, she was parachuted into France in 1944 to work behind enemy lines. And the advantage that women had over men was that they weren't expected to be working or on service or conscripted for labour for the Germans or whatever. So they could move much more freely around the countryside on trains, by bike or walking. So they had a kind of invisibility that men didn't. That's the distinction.
Can we talk about some of her exploits? Because she did things like smuggling things by ski routes across the border from Poland and sneaking around with kind of micro dots sewn into things. And
sneaking around, kind of, I'm not sure I used that. Well, her first role, she was based in Budapest in Hungary. She was given an alias as a French journalist. But her role was, I mean, this is in the midwinter, she arrived 4 days before Christmas, and she was skiing across the High Tatra Mountains, sometimes in minus 40 degrees, so absolutely perilous. You know, and occasionally, shockingly, she would pass the bodies of people who'd been coming the sensible way, trying to get out of occupied Poland towards Hungary, who'd frozen to death in the mountains. And she had, you know, in those days, it was wooden, heavy skis that were strapped on, very hard work. So she would ski in, and what she was doing was taking in money and propaganda for the fledgling Polish resistance and bringing out, you know, radio codes, coding books, and of course, microfilm, which she smuggled inside her leather gloves back out to the Allies the other way.
And she was someone who was, I mean, she went in theatre of operations in Egypt, in Italy, in Poland, in France, all over the place. And she was in and out of favour, wasn't she, with her spy masters during her career? Why was that?
Yes, she was. She's very controversial in every sense. You know, she's female. We didn't, for the first year, she was the only female special agent. She's part Jewish, so that comes with lots of associations. She's not British, but she's working for the British. But she's, in her heart, she's working for Poland. So she's got mixed allegiances, if you like. Although, of course, they were allies. It didn't mean they were entirely, their aims were entirely together. So at one point, she's talking to an independent Polish resistance group called the Musketeers. And they are talking both to the Russians on one side and to the Germans on the other side. because Poland, of course, was threatened on two fronts by these two different powers. So it's entirely logical for the Poles to be talking to both sides. And because of that, she was tainted or tarred with that same brush. So at one point, she arrives in after this incredible journey through Europe in the spring of 1941, driving through countries with her one-legged lover and colleague in arms, you know, sometimes just weeks before those countries joined the Axis, on one occasion just days before. And she finally arrives at the safety of the British base in Cairo, and they completely put her on ice. And it's just this appalling treatment. And it later turns out they're investigating reports that she's a double agent. Partly it just seems the only way she can still be alive.
It seems to me that she was someone who was, just reading from the account in your book, who was always up for it, was something of an adrenaline junkie.
Yes.
She didn't seem to me, from your account, to be a massively academic person, but her character was what made her this person who could slip in and out of worlds and smuggle things and facilitate all of the sabotage that SOE...
she's one of huge appetites, I think. I mean, she wasn't a stupid person. She went to a convent school and her grades were very good. You know, she was doing well. But she was chucked out of her convent school because, you know, one morning she was bored during... It was a Catholic convent school and they were saying Mass in the morning. It was still dark, very tedious, and she was cold. She decided to try and speed things up. They're all holding candles, the girls. And she thought if she set light to the priest's cassocks, it might speed up the whole process. And it did, of course, because she was expelled. So she was a clever woman, but she was very determined in other regards, but not academically. Her other appetites overruled her.
And she also very much enjoyed the high life, didn't she?
She did.
She was someone who would turn up glamorously in the social sort of arenas in these various different countries and live as this sophisticated woman as well.
Well, her glamour, I think, was very much in her personality rather than in her appearance. I mean, she was very beautiful. Before the war, she was awarded Star of Beauty in the first Miss Poland Beauty National Beauty Competition. And she used her beauty queen photograph in which she's wearing a fur coat and not much else, even in her passport. She was quite a vain woman. But most of the time, she just wore very well-cut shirts and skirts and trousers. And she didn't go for the big, glamorous clothing look.
She was...
But she was magnetic anyhow.
She was someone who was recognised even by Winston Churchill as having made a major contribution to...
Well, so Winston Churchill's daughter said.
Oh,
yes.
I see. Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. I see. Yeah.
She reported back that...
She was decorated, though, wasn't she, several times?
She was highly decorated, She had the George Medal, the OBE. The French also decorated her. They gave her the Croix de Guerre with one star. And she had an array of ribbons that any general would have been proud of. An extraordinary...
Well, it's an account of an absolutely incredible life, and I can recommend it as a very good read to any of our listeners. What's the next project you're going to be working on, huh?
Oh, well, yes, I'm very excited. I have just signed my next book deal, and I'm sticking in the Second World War. And I wanted to move away from it. There are so many books, but then I came across another story that is incredible about these two extraordinary women whose lives intersect. Very dramatic stories again, but something very different to this one. So I'm just starting out on that now.
Claire Mully, thank you very much indeed for sharing such an incredible book with me. It's great, absolutely wonderful.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks very much. Thank you.
It's been an interesting month in terms of things to discover in the city centre, as thought-provoking work by a group of artists known as Black Rats Projects opened at Changing Spaces in Green Street. A collaboration of work by eight artists presented Memento Mori, which loosely means Remember You Die, revisiting the artist's obsession with death and a Victorian tradition of keepsakes of loved ones who die. Changing Spaces director Angie Main introduces the work.
Angie, some wonderful things at the window here at 10 Green Street. An enormous skull of a hippopotamus, which I gather is an antiquity.
That's correct, yes.
And then also Charles Walker's moving bag. Can you describe that to me?
Yes, of course. It's an old sack, old coffee bean sack, strung up to the ceiling. And inside there is something that moves. So we have quite a lot of fun, actually, with the audience, because it's crowds of people have been collecting around it, getting them to guess what's inside.
Okay, now this exhibition is called the Black Rats Arts Project, is that right?
No, the exhibition is called Memento Mori, and it's the second collaboration between Changing Spaces and Black Rat Projects in London.
Okay, it's a group exhibition on three floors. Who's featuring and why do they fit together, basically, on this one?
Right, these are artists that are part of Black Rat's group of artists that they have and sell their work. It ranges from painters to sculptors like Giles, who's well-known in Cambridge.
Now, it seems to be... the theme that loosely ties it together is an obsession with death, which of course, yes. is a very long-running one with artists. Can you tell me a little bit about how that idea develops through the exhibition?
It's Memento Mori. Mm. It's actually the second exhibition because Black Rat had the one previously in London last year. It's all to do with the, you know, the different artists' association with or collecting things that have to do with death, or with, for instance, you know, going back to the Victorian attitude towards Memento Mori, who were very, they used to make a lot of artifacts out of dead loved ones' hair, for instance.
Basically, it's all about somber thoughts and coming to terms with death, isn't it?
And something that happens to us all. And I think actually it can be quite somber going through it. Yeah. But then at the end, there's the video installation, which is absolutely splendid, which we send everyone to after, which shows the actual cycle of life.
Yeah. The video is great because it's down a whitened and dark corridor that you stand at one end of, and it's projected onto the wall.
Yes.
And there's this very exciting face which changes into colourful things, into skulls, a little bit like the skulls at the beginning of Live and Let Die, the James Bond film. And you've also got lots of exhibits here which centre around skulls, crossbones, skeletons superimposed on photographs, Butch Antony's, things like Pussy Wit. What's that piece about, do you know?
That one is one of my favourites, Pussy Wit. Yeah. What I really like about it is how he's used collage and paint as well, because I think that's taking it a step further. I remember looking at these when I first saw them in London, and I looked and it was, oh my God, these photographs, this is the state these photographs of these people are in now. You know, they are all skeletons.
It's great because what you've got here is you've got a whole room full of, they're Victorian photographic portraits, which is then superimposed skeleton outlines on, and things like, you know, adjusted the eyes, then put in these captions or what have you. And it's a great sense of kind of, as you just said, you know, that all of those people are stone dead skeletons and skulls. And it kind of almost brings them back to life to haunt you, doesn't it?
I don't think it's haunting you. I think it's just, I mean, I just see it, it's a bit Dadaist, really. I think that's maybe what it's closest to, you know, kind of contemporary Dada.
There's also Candy's Trips, which has these figurines in very large dome glass cases, lots and lots of them. What's the origin of that one?
The origin of that is she did a show with Giles Walker just before Christmas, and she's mainly does she's actually an illustrator, and so it was a kind of combination of both their work. You know, she made a few little creatures that actually related well to, which were like out of her paintings actually, and there were masses of them all over the place, and this is just taking a few of them and making them into kind of exhibits in their own right.
Giles deals in some very peculiar things, doesn't he, which lots of those are around in this exhibition. They're little figurines which are made from the skulls of small birds into little creatures, and he's an absolute expert at that, reproducing the most peculiar and weird and mind-bending little things like that.
He's a fantastic artist, and I think, you know, we're so lucky to be able to show his work. You know, there was the exhibition last July, and then more work here. And we are hoping to bring Giles back in a solo show, and also we're hoping to do Butch Antony as well as solo shows. We've been planning this exhibition for about a year now, and really waiting for the ideal venue. And I think because this old 17th century building with these amazing panels, wooden panels, which are like artworks in their own right, it's really difficult to put work in here that doesn't get lost. But because of the timelessness of this particular exhibition, we think it's been very successful.
And Jumaine, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, if Memento Mori didn't chill the spine pleasantly just a little bit, an even more thought-provoking event took place at the university lecture halls, perhaps as a result of Cambridge's commitment to the right to freedom of the mind. Visions of Enchantment and Occultism, Spirituality and Visual Culture was a two-day conference in collaboration between Cambridge University's Department of Art History and the Art History of Bournemouth in association with the European Society for the Study of Western Esotericism. The serious study of the history and nature of occult ideas, witchcraft, alchemy and devil worship has traditionally been a somewhat taboo amongst serious academics, who risk being marked as crackpots. that back in medieval times would have risked being burned at the stake for taking an unhealthy interest in it. At this event, academics from around the world presented 38 papers on esotericism and art and analysed its proper place in literature, academia and art history as an origin of recurring and powerful ideas that we just can't ignore. Someone said at the conference that art is religion, and that was certainly true when attending a lecture on talismanic charts and the role of vision, both of Arabic and Persian origins, with Professor Emily Savage-Smith of Oxford University, who investigated the content of striking talisman that promised to protect you from all kinds of misfortunes simply by wearing it, laying it out or performing a small ritual with it. She presented slides of a roll of paper in a cylinder, which when unfurled could deliver 100 wishes granted, 70 for the next world and 30 for this one, giving, for example, success in your affairs, protection from enemies, magic or malicious accusations, injury from weapons of war, immunity from plague, sudden death or birth hazards, and even freedom from slavery and cures for just about anything. People seriously felt that this art could invoke forces other than God to protect houses from bad spirits or a bad future. A gripping talk was given by Professor Ellie Warlick from the University of Denver, an expert on alchemy and surrealism, and author of A Magician in Search of a Myth, currently engaged in the study of the history of alchemaic philosophy and visual images. Her recent book, Alchemia, Women, Gender and Sexuality in Alchemical Images, is concerned with analysing this subject through a feminist lens. We looked at medieval ideas about philosopher's stones and the role of nudity in depictions of witchcraft in women and the inherent misogyny in the art that suggested that no woman could be left on her own without getting up to diabolical occult mischief with the features of her own new body. The themes explored by other speakers included recurring ideas of inversion, perversion, original sin, demonization, paganism, magic, rebellion, liberation, reversion and nudity, with envy being cited as the core motivation for practicing witchcraft. Here's conference organiser Judith Noble of the Arts University of Bournemouth.
What's this whole conference about, basically?
Well, it's about visual culture and the occult and the esoteric and the spiritual. And it's been a year in the planning, and it's about a whole range of ideas, a really wide breadth of anything to do with art, magic, the occult.
These images of witches and sorcerers and demons and so on and so forth, why is it so interesting, do you think, to people?
Well, I think it's perennially interesting because to a kind of general audience, it's showing us a side of humanity that fascinates us, a side that's a bit transgressive and that we're not supposed to look at if we're good, nice people, but for artists and art historians, there's been a huge reassessment of the place of the occult within the arts, particularly within the modern. So it's been ignored for a long time and now it's being looked at.
It's an entire strand of European thought and literature that has been absolutely essential for the things that we do enjoy in art and ideas, and yet it is quite often regarded as a taboo subject, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I think that's partly because of our religious and spiritual heritage, but it's also because we live in a very materialistic society which doesn't like the idea of the spiritual and the esoteric per se.
Do you think people need to actually sort of step out of the box a bit when they look at these kind of ideas and to understand them fully?
I think it depends what their starting point is. Some people do it very naturally and it's part of their psyche and their world anyway. But yes, if they don't, yes, they do need to step out of the box and just start thinking from scratch, really.
What are the more surprising things that come up in this series of talks that are particularly this time round and being discussed?
Well, we're only a quarter of the way through, but I particularly enjoyed the last session that we have and the looking at images of witchcraft and particularly the images of old women, because you don't very often see images of old women in our current society, so that's extremely interesting.
I mean, the misogyny was quite obvious, isn't it? I mean, it was actually the way women were treated in the past comes across very strongly when you discuss the way that they're treated in the medieval ideas, you know, absolutely to almost demonise women and say they can't be trusted to be left on their own.
Yeah, stunning, isn't it? But how different is it from now?
And we're going on to do some stuff on the effect of magic and witchcraft on contemporary art. That's the next thing.
That's what we're looking at now.
What will that talk be covering?
Well, there are a whole range of talks, a whole section of things about modernism, about painters like Jackson Pollock. I'm looking at the work of filmmaker Derek Jarman, and somebody is examining very contemporary performance and music, people like Lady Gaga and Diamanda Galas.
Mm-hmm. Judith, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
Thank you. The feminist revolution of the late 1960s brought significant changes to Western society. It also impacted the scholarship of every academic discipline, including the history of art and the history of science. Scholars began to question why women's achievements of the past had been discounted. They began to analyze the domestic, religious, political, and institutional barriers that had impeded women's education and their pursuit of more public roles in society. As the evidence mounted, it seemed that almost nowhere in the history of the Western world could a time be found when women and their accomplishments were valued on par with those of men.
Everything from the study of Shakespeare's witches to tarot, conjuring, alchemy, astrology, and even works by artists like Goya depicting the stealing and cannibalising of children as a theme were looked at. We then moved on to dream states and connections in the human mind and notions of telepathy and forceful energy, and then the secrets of animal magnetism and on to mesmerism. The author of The Red Goddess, Peter Gray, who's co-founder of the Scarlet Imprint, a cult esoteric talismanic book publisher, presented modern magic books from across Europe for people actively using magic in their daily lives. The array of magic books span paganism, necromancy, exorcism, apocalyptic witchcraft, sorcery cults, demonology, folk magic, wolves, devils and goddesses, madness, and just about anything else you might find potentially unnerving at night. That includes current Brazilian and African witchcraft, and the books themselves are credited with talismanic powers. He says any critical moment in life can be changed by using magic.
My name's Peter Gray. I'm the co-founder of Scarlet Imprint, and we're an occult, esoteric, talismanic book publisher.
You've got some very esoteric-looking books in front of me. Can you tell me a little bit about what's in there?
Certainly. We publish practitioner material, so that's the work of active magicians and witches across a variety of traditions, from European witchcraft traditions through grimoire magic tradition practitioners, to a variety of diaspora religions, from Kimbanda to Palameombe to Voodoo. So basically we're the cutting edge of what's happening in living magic today.
What is happening in living magic today?
There's a huge renaissance going on, largely as a result of people having the ability to talk to each other internationally. So the internet's had a huge impact, the scholarly production of material has had a huge impact, and also just the ability of people to come out and be honest about what they're doing.
And what are they doing? I mean, practicing witchcraft? Or?
They're practicing witchcraft, they're practicing magic, they're doing what they've been doing since the dawn of time, but with less fear of being burned for it.
Yeah, I mean, that was very much, I mean, a lot of people sort of believe that this sort of belief had basically petered out in the West due to sort of the modern world and what have you. Obviously, it still goes on in Africa, but it's interesting to hear.
Sure, our tradition in the West has been very much talked down, when in fact we have a continuous magical tradition, as we can see through the grimoires, the magical books of Europe through the medieval period, which have roots which go back to ancient Greece and the near Middle East, which show continuous practice has occurred in the West, and we do have a spiritual tradition.
This morning we've been looking at some various talisman and explanations of what they contain and how they protect you. Are there things that you believe can actually protect people from bad forces or evil elements like that?
Yeah,
how do those work?
There's a whole variety of talismans which are Kampali, as we saw this morning, through the Arabic influence, whether that's magical squares or whether that's the combination of objects, the use of gemstones, and indeed that kind of magic is very much alive in the West.
Can you give me some examples of the kind of thing that's contained in these books?
Keynotes, we've got a lot of work on the medieval grimoires, so there's been a lot of interest in how our own native magical traditions have been preserved and have been worked with. and modern practitioners are now putting these into forms which are approachable and have cut out a lot of the mistakes in the material. And also we've got a lot of practical work, especially feeding in from the African diaspora religions in terms of more practical magic. So the work from hoodoo, the work from voodoo, and to provide the results that they require.
Obviously there's a strong tradition in academia, and especially in a place like Cambridge, that people who actually want to look at these kind of ideas and the effect they have on art, and obviously the origins of ideas that are widely used, the people who take too much of an interest in it are effectively dismissed as academics on the grounds that they're regarded as being, you know, slightly kooky.
I think there's always a suspicion that the academics have gone native. I think that's been a long-standing concern of the academy with people who pursue the esoteric. And in my experience as a practitioner outside of the academic community, the academics are a mix. So there are academics who are practitioners, and there are academics who quite clearly aren't.
Yeah.
And I think that the academic study of magic has come on great leaps and bounds, and it's now being taken very seriously as a discipline, whereas previously it was being dismissed as a crackpot pursuit.
It's obviously interesting to record and explore all of these ideas and their origins. But I mean, what kind of things do you explore with magic? Just anything that can happen in life in the same way that sort of...
Yeah, any of the critical moments in life can be altered by magic.
Yeah.
So magic is there for birth, death, marriage, love, lust, business, money, all the basic human concerns are met there.
Well, sponsors, Abraxas Journal of Esoteric Studies is a beautifully made biannual glossy magazine created in 2009 that takes up centre stage in the niche and is an interface between esoteric study of art and culture and practitioners with academia, and represents the best of the international esoteric scene, containing essays and images spanning the magical and creative nexus. The subject matter of its latest issue, which attempts the serious study of the occult, has articles on magical oils, the history of demons, the history of homosexual gods, spirituality, and symbolist circles. Magazine founder and publisher Robert Ansell says esoteric studies is a field whose time has come.
Okay, first of all, tell me about Abraxas. How did it come about and what does it do?
Well, Abraxas is an idea I've had for a number of years, which came to fruition in 2009 with a joint venture with my friend Christina Oakley Harrington of Treadwell's Bookshop. For many years, I've been somewhat dismayed in the way that mainstream culture marginalises the esoteric. And the idea behind Abraxas was to create a vehicle which has cultural mobility, to take some of the ideas that are in the esoteric community to a wider audience.
So it's basically about properly understanding what these ideas are and what part they play in the art that we see all around us. Is that what it is?
Absolutely, and the part they have played in the past, which is considerable, actually.
What is in the latest edition of the Abraxas Journal, and why is it interesting?
We've got a fantastic feature by Sasha Chaitau on Peladan, who was a very interesting individual at the turn of the last century, who was putting forward ideas that art is a religion,
yeah.
Which is quite an advance of his time. We've got some fantastic writing on abramelin oil. We've got features from an artist in Seattle on Dionysian mysteries. It's incredibly diverse. I'm here today to speak on Austin Osmond Spare, yeah. Who is an artist who was active between 1900 and 1956. And he's seen as a sort of proto-surrealist because he had a lot of ideas which were later adopted by surrealism. Mm. And I'm here today to talk about his relationship to the absolute and the way he approached that.
Witchcraft is just so much hot air, but its odour lingers, was the finishing note quotation left by Professor Diana Papridge. And perhaps she's right, you can't quite dismiss its effect on the psyche fully. They say once tasted, an actor's life runs deep in the blood and never really leaves the dramatically afflicted, as I discovered when talking to a serious-minded publisher lately, who has a past many young people with talent might seriously envy today. Colin Walsh, whose past stage name was actor Colin West, is now a Cambridge author and publisher, and was awarded an honorary degree with Anglia Ruskin University for his input into their publishing MA course. But in a previous incarnation, he admitted being part of a television legend. He dropped into 105 to confess his sins.
Colin, you're originally an actor. Tell me a bit about yourself and about your past.
I read psychology, which in the 60s was probably about as much use as sticking your head in a bucket of vomit. So after I left, I changed my name from Colin Walsh to Colin West. Don't ask me why West. It just seemed right. No one wanted to know if you'd been a student and so on, but what they want to know if you've been acting elsewhere. And so I made up a complete history for myself and talked about acting in reps that I knew no self-respecting agent would ever visit, obscure places. Also, my sister was an actress. She went to RADA and she was in Coronation Street, and she was in quite a lot of television, mainly broadcast, but also she played in Billy Lyre, which was a big play in the late 60s. And so I had some idea of what it took. I had a lot of 10x8 photographs, and I wrote to all the agents till gradually I got accepted by a couple of them.
Okay, we're going to come back to your acting career in a moment, but you worked for quite some time for The Spectator under Nigel Lawson, didn't you?
Yes, after I decided I had to earn some money and I wasn't going to be earning it from acting, I applied for various jobs. And then I heard on a network that there was a job going at The Spectator, and I joined The Spectator as a sort of literary PR and investment manager. I was in charge of literary pages, those who advertised, and particularly I held 5 literary lunches a week, one every day from roughly about 11:30 in the morning till about 4 at night, which included the sherry to start with and the brandy to finish with.
That sounds fantastic. And what was Nigel Lawson like to work under?
He was fine. I only knew him as an editor. I mean, I didn't know him until I joined The Spectator. And it shows you how naive I was. I'm a Liverpudlian. And up in Liverpool, I don't think The Spectator had ever penetrated. So I had no idea. It was such a Tory paper. And and he was editor. He was pretty genial with us, but in those days, the editor was on high, and you crawled into the office on all fours to say hello. But there were some great names on The Spectator in those days. Hilary Sperling was the literary editor. Trevor Grove was the assistant literary editor. All of those doing their stuff much later on. And it was just a terrific venue. I could invite any writers I liked to lunch. People like William Boyd, who were just sort of starting out. And we held these lunches, and we never talked about advertising. We only talked about literary works.
Well, that sounds like an ideal job. And you went on to Cambridge University Press, and you've been the author of 10 books. What's the latest one about?
The latest one I'm doing is called The Baby Boomers' Bible. If you were born roughly between 1945 and 65, you're a baby boomer. And the baby boomers have got something like 70% of the UK's wealth between them. It's the richest source of response for anyone advertising. And the baby boomers are, to some extent, being blamed as though they've pinched everything from current generations. We didn't, they didn't. And the baby boomers' Bible is what you will need to get you through on the next few decades.
Okay, now that's who you are, this very sensible character, who you are today. But what we've come here to talk about is another side to your character, which is that, in fact, you've been a monster.
What's the Shakespearean quote? It is of mine own nature. Yes, I was a monster. I was a dominator.
The Dominator was a monster in the Doctor Who series. Which series was that one in?
Do you know, this was in the 60s, and it was about 1968. So I never saw Doctor Who, didn't know what the hell it was about. But Patrick Troughton was the Doctor Who. And all I knew was I got a call from my agent to say they want someone to be dressed up and made up as a monster. And having seen what you do in your previous television bits, you do go along for it. So I went along with another mate to be interviewed. There were two of us. And they said, which of you is the hairiest? And after a quick examination, not too exhaustive, it turned out that I was, which turned out to be my advantage, because one of us had to wear a miniskirt. And I wore a long robe, and any exposed skin either of us had was covered in cold porridge. They poured latex on our burr patches, then they poured cold porridge, then they took a hair dryer and they dried the porridge onto you so it became your grey mottled skin.
So what did you look like as a dominator? I mean,
it was grim. Our heads were blotted out with a plastic scalp. They put bits of hair at random bits all over our faces and body. They blanked our eyes out with fish skin. And then they gave us the equivalent of 10p today and said, look, it's lunchtime, but you look so horrible. We can't allow you to go into the BBC canteen. And we were sent along to the sandwich machine, where for 2 shillings, as it was then, you got a pretty poor sandwich, but one good enough for a monster. And so we went along and stood in the queue. And as people turned round, there was a sort of scream, and people were put off their sandwiches, which meant we didn't have to pay for them. It was very nice. We went back to our dressing room, being assigned to us, but we had all this latex and porridge over our faces, and we couldn't crack it. So you had to shove the sandwich through a tiny slit in your lips, but you couldn't munch. And I don't recall whether I liked that sandwich or not, but I'm sure it was very tasty on the floor.
Did you meet the characters who played the master and the brigadier, as well as the doctor, or was your role very sort of confined to one few scenes?
The role was pretty confined, but yes, I did meet them all, because once you were in a series, you were going to be shooting all the time. And even in those days, the late 60s, they videoed all performances, so everyone had to wait to make sure that all the takes were fine. And so, yeah, it was great to meet all the regular characters in the series.
I mean, the resources available to Doctor Who now are absolutely unbelievable, with people like David Tennant and Matt Smith playing Doctor Who. They've got much more money, because originally it was shot on a pretty limited budget, wasn't it?
Most of it was made of cardboard, as indeed I was in those days. And it was a Kellogg's packet budget. You know, you cut the eyes out of the packet. It was never seen as going to be as big as it was, so it never attracted the money till much later. And whether or not that's a good thing, I don't know.
Do you ever go to the Doctor Who conventions? Where
no, no, I haven't. I have known people. They've had them in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I know there have been some moves to have whole cast going, but I think if you covered me in porridge now and fried it with a hairdryer, you wouldn't really notice any difference.
Thank you very much indeed for coming in and telling 105 about
that. You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
It's time to take a glimpse at what's coming up in the city in the coming weeks. West Road Concert Hall hosts masterpiece Bach's St John's Passion with Britten Sinfonia on April the 16th, featuring a pre-concert talk by soprano Julia Doyle and tenor Lestin Davis. Cambridge Drawing Society's art exhibition opens at the Guildhall on April the 5th and runs till April the 12th, with free entry between 10 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. Cambridgeshire County Youth Orchestra performs at the Corn Exchange on April the 13th with work by Holst, Vaughan Williams and Patterson. At the Arts Theatre on Monday, April 14th and 15th, Ballet Black features classically trained black and Asian dancers and celebrates dance from around the world. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Arts Roundup. I hope you've enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105 FM, and we'll send us your arts news in and around Cambridge.